Hello, America, and welcome to a new edition of John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News, where today we have a very special groundbreaking guest. Why do I say that? Well, because on January 3rd, at the ripe old age of 25, Madison Cawthorn is going to be sworn in as the youngest member in Congress in a very, very long time. The youngest Republican ever, and one of the youngest in well over many decades, I think going back to the 1940s and 50s. Real remarkable storyline, because he ran in the Republican primary against a candidate that President Trump and Mark Meadows, the chief of staff and former member in the House seat in North Carolina that Madison ultimately won. And he beat that candidate. You know, he's a big Trump guy, but he beat the Trump preferred candidate because he was younger, more energetic, had a better ground game, and he won. And then he sailed into the general election and beat the Democrats' hand-picked candidate. And wow, he won again. And now, at the age of 25, on January 3rd, 2021, he'll be sworn in to represent the 11th District of North Carolina on the western side of North Carolina. He's got lots of ideas on shrinking government, coming up with a conservative market-based healthcare plan, humbling or taking down a notch the big tech companies with their censorship and a monopolistic oligarchic-like behavior. And so we're going to talk to him. He's got a lot of ideas. He's a young guy. He's going to have to feel his way around Washington. Washington's not a town you learn in 2 minutes, but he's got a real bright future potentially. And we're going to have him here for the whole show to talk about what is it like to be a young congressman, what was orientation like, and what's on the agenda. What can he do in a Democratic-controlled House with a very narrow Democratic majority to get some things done? He has some ideas on infrastructure. I think he'll talk about bipartisan opportunity there. I think he also has some ideas on the big tech monopolies and what can be done that would satisfy both Democrats and Republicans. Obviously, Democrats want to shrink them from a monopolistic antitrust perspective. Republicans want to shrink them or break the censorship hold that they have on American free speech. And I think he's got some bright ideas, some concepts, some policy ideas that we can all talk and learn from today. All right, so we're going to have Madison Cawthorn on in a little bit. We're going to go to a quick commercial break here from our great advertisers. When we come back, we are going to first talk about some of the truisms and some of the falsehoods in the election integrity investigation. Yes, there are some bad stories out there put out by conservatives or embraced by conservatives that are wrong. And there are some very, very important ones that maybe aren't getting the attention they deserve. I'm going to talk about that right when we get back from this commercial break. Hey, folks, as we approach another critical election, a wave of concern washes over America. Recent studies reveal that an astonishing 56% of our fellow citizens report feelings of anxiety or dread about the upcoming presidential election. That's why I stand with AMAC. AMAC is more than a senior discount organization. During these challenging times, they fight for common sense and hope that our nation returns to traditional American values. Visit amac.us/justnews today to seize an exclusive election year special, a 4-year AMAC membership for just $30. That's right, you heard me right, 4 years for 30 bucks. As an AMAC member, you're not only enjoying money-saving benefits, but also the AMAC magazine, free Social Security and Medicare advice, a trusted voice in Washington, and a community of like-minded patriots who love this great nation. Take advantage of this election year special, 4 years for $30, and be part of the solution over the next 4 years. By becoming an AMAC member, you're strengthening a movement dedicated to preserving the principles we hold dear in this great country. Join now at amac.us/justnews. That's amac.us/justnews. All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. And as promised, in a few minutes, we are going to have Madison Cawthorn, soon to be the youngest member of Congress on January 3rd, now the youngest congressman-elect for the new Congress coming up next year. He's going to be joining us. He'll be representing the 11th District in Western North Carolina, a real up-and-comer in the conservative ranks, a Gen Z freedom-loving, liberty-loving member that I think is going to tug at the heartstrings of the older generation in Congress and challenge some preconceptions. Yeah, you're going to want to hear what he has to say. He's a fun interview and full of ideas, and so we'll be following him and see how that works. I wanted to mention some things that are out there floating around that need to be both confirmed or knocked down, because the time for conservatives to make their case that there was election irregularities and fraud that actually materially could have changed the election is shrinking. A lot of the cases that have been put forth so far have not succeeded, in part because there's been a reliance on things that aren't fully locked down. There hasn't been an effort to really find the numeric proof that would say, hey, yes, these frauds occurred, but it also occurred on a scale that could have changed President Trump's 20,000 lead in Wisconsin or 82,000 lead in that state and 150,000 lead in another state and 12,000 in this state, I think, or 12,000 in Georgia, if I remember correctly. It is time for the lawyers to either put up or get out of the way, because the time is coming for the electors to be named. And so far, a lot of the heat-seeking missiles that have been launched just have not hit their target. So what I tried to do over the weekend is pull together. I read every affidavit, every lawsuit, every statistical analysis. I went through all of the work that we have done at justthenews.com on our election integrity project, where we've put out real facts, real data, real people with names, people who said my vote wasn't counted when I voted for Trump, or I am listed as voting and I didn't even file a ballot, so how could it be? There must be fraud. We've got the statistical analysis that Matt Brainerd did for us that really shows the potential, at least in Pennsylvania. We're trying to extend that to other states as we raise money for the project. We are getting data. We are getting real names and numbers that can be withstand the scrutiny and possibly withstand a court challenge. Our job is not to argue or to help President Trump, hurt President Trump. Our job is just to get the American people the data that they need to show that what is going on in the election space is troubling or not troubling. In some cases, Joe Biden might have won a state fair and square. But we want to get to the bottom of that and address these questions. And so what I did is I put together what I call the dozen best examples of election integrity or election irregularities that we've been able to document, meaning there's real proof, not just, you know, hey, I think something bad happened, but real things. And I want to go through them. But before I do, I want to address one of the theories that some conservatives have ballied about. It starts with the idea that votes were just changed in the machines without other corresponding evidence, algorithm changes. I've heard a lot about this, but if you study the state systems like we did, and I mean, we have 30 reporters in six states that have dug into this day and night, a algorithm change of data, just magically changing, poof, doesn't actually hold up. Here's why. As soon as they would get to a recount, or as soon as they got to an audit, as have happened in many of these states, if there wasn't a corresponding paper ballot, if there wasn't a corresponding person who showed up in the poll book and in the poll day, the algorithm would be exposed immediately, and it would be an easy slam dunk, embarrassing election fraud. I don't believe those who, if there were people who are trying to hijack the election, and again, I think that's an open question. There's certainly evidence of some fraud and untoward and behavior and misconduct, clearly. But that doesn't mean that yet we've proven that there was a widespread systemic fraud yet. Now we're seeing signs of it. The data analysis we did in Pennsylvania suggests it. But the idea that a machine just changed votes and there's no corresponding paper ballots to back that up would be exposed in a second. I think that the German raid, remember the German raid that we heard about? Oh, they seized, I don't know, was it Dominion or someone else's servers? It's just not true. It didn't happen. The raid that was caught on video occurred in July. July. It had nothing to do with the election or the post-election period. There's a lot of misinformation that conservatives have pursued. they're wasting their time and they're wasting the American people's attention and they're wasting valuable days to get to the bottom of what may be real and legitimate fraud or misconduct or irregularities. Now, again, whether or not that holds up, you know, whether it's widespread enough, we'll see. I do think just a few minutes ago, the federal appeals court in the middle of our country gave an expedited review to President Trump's election claims in Pennsylvania. That's a win. That's a big moment. It means that a higher court is going to take a look at their evidence. But now it's incumbent on the Trump campaign, the Amistad Project, all of the key players to put the best evidence forward to say not only were there irregularities, because we've documented irregularities, but the irregularities were widespread enough that they could materially have changed the outcome of the election. That is the burden of proof. It's time for the president to get that proof out there and not stop chasing wild dreams, or I shouldn't say he's chasing them, but some of the lawyers and some of the activists have been chasing things that just aren't there. If there was a systemic fraud, what we've learned from the experts, what we learned from our own data crunching, what we learned from reviews, it likely would have occurred in the form of a modern day ballot box stuffing, meaning that at the end of the night, Democratic officials in some of these cities knew the gap that Trump had, how much he was in the lead, and they could have. I'm not saying they did it, but the most likely scenario that has been placed forward has been that they stuffed the ballot boxes in the early morning with absentee ballots with anyone who hadn't voted. They put a name to it and stuck it in a ballot box. That's an allegation. It is not proven yet. But we do see some very important pieces of evidence. That's why I put together my my list of stories, because I think it's absolutely essential that we look at what is provable, not what is theorizable or conspiratorial theorizable. So listen, we've talked about the Jesse Jacob affidavit. I still think that's the single most important piece of proof that has been offered in terms of a systemic fraud effort in Detroit. Why? Because we know she participated in it. She says she was asked to backdate ballots, ballot requests. She witnessed on a daily basis people not checking the voter IDs. And the day after the election, she was told and admits she did, as did 80 other people like her. So think of the scope and scale. 80 people did this, backdated large numbers of ballots to make them look like they had come in before the election when, in fact, they had come in on November 4th. If the Democrats had a Jesse Jacob, they would be parading her about just like they did with that Ukraine whistleblower. She's the ultimate whistleblower. For some reason, the Republicans haven't dug in enough to realize she's an eyewitness participant in alleged fraud. She sticks her name to it. She's in a Democratic city, a civil servant, worked for her city for a long time. No reason to lie. She's credible, at least on the prima facie. Now, you know, everyone could lie, but she stands up as a compelling whistleblower witness. If Adam Schiff had her, he'd be parading her about town. The conservatives and Republicans and the campaign have not done more investigating to find out who were the other 80 people. Do they agree? Who were the supervisors? Can they be subpoenaed? It's a missed opportunity, but the single best proof, remember, she says thousands of ballots were being changed every day. That's her testimony. That's an important thing. Certainly thousands of ballots a day after. And then she described a period of 60 days where these supervisors were instructing illegal behavior every day to be carried out by election workers, not checking voter ID, backdating ballot requests. There is a roadmap to a criminal case, a civil RICO case sitting in there. And she, it would appear, could identify 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 more witnesses based on her affidavit. To me, it's the most important piece of evidence that has been out there because it has a scope and scale that could be material to the outcome. Secondly, staying in Detroit, we now know from the Wayne County Board of Canvassing Republicans, William Hartman particularly, that the books in Detroit, the books of approved, authorized voters, don't match the ballots. If you take that and you extrapolate from what we already know from Jesse Jacobs' affidavit, there is a giant red flag sitting over the city of Detroit with provable information, and that needs to be drilled down to in a very quick way, a very important piece of the puzzle. Now, remember, we talked about ballot stuffing and ballot box stuffing as the likely means, not some mysterious computers changing numbers, because at the end of the day, if the computers changed numbers and there were no ballots to back it up, it would have been exposed right away. If there was a fraud, there's almost certainty, a high degree of certainty, ballots had to be created and run through the machines to pull it off. Well, in Georgia, we have evidence from the great attorney Lynn Wood, who's been very successful throughout his life. 9 observers have put their name to affidavits saying that during the recent audit last week, the recount that occurred last week in Georgia, they saw large stacks of what are known as pristine ballots, meaning they weren't folded. They had no other markings on them. Why is that important? You're supposed to fold an absentee ballot and stick it into an envelope and sign the envelope, which means there would be fold marks and other marks on these ballots. Again, if you were rushing to do a ballot box stuffing episode, and I'm not, operation, and I'm saying we're proving that, I'm just saying that's the most logical of the theories based on the evidence that's currently in these affidavits. You probably wouldn't have time to fold them and put them in an envelope. Listen to what these Georgia affidavits are saying, that in fact they saw unfolded pristine ballots for Joe Biden being recounted. That's a real red flag that needs to be checked out. And of course, in Georgia, we have some other things. If you look at the list of things I've done, there's several thousand, 5,000 to 6,000 ballots that never got counted on election day. They were lost. They were only found during the audit. That's a troubling sign of things ahead. And then, of course, we had our big review last week. We already talked about it. I'll just mention it. But the sworn declarations, the people we interviewed, the statistical analysis of the Yale-trained mathematician Stephen Miller, Yale and Princeton trained math expert, now at Williams College, saying that based on interviews, data, and other reviews, he can confidently say he thinks there are as many as 100,000 suspect ballots just on 2 areas. People who said they voted and their vote didn't get counted yet, all of them being Republicans. And those who said that they didn't request a ballot and a ballot was filed in their name, meaning voter fraud, 2 very important acknowledgments by a real expert and written in a declaration that could withstand a court thing. We have many others like this. I'm not going to go through all of them. Go ahead and read the story on justthenews.com. The headline is, and I encourage you to read it because there are 12 of them. They're very solid and all the underlying proof is in the story. The headline is 12 compelling allegations of voting irregularities in the 2020 election by yours truly, John Solomon. All right, one more commercial break. When we come back, as promised, I'll stop teasing it. We're really going to get to Madison Cawthorn, the soon-to-be youngest member of Congress, a Republican from the great state of North Carolina, right after this commercial break. Folks, if you owe back taxes, fair warning, you're not going to like this. The IRS is mailing millions of pay-up letters. Millions, I say. Then it's up to the 20,000 new IRS enforcement agents to find you. Why the IRS targets you and not millionaires? Well, because millionaires have tax lawyers. You don't. You'll pay up. Plus interest and penalties. You need Tax Network USA, and you need them now. Tax Network USA has brilliant war room strategies to solve your IRS problems quickly and in your favor. Like a preferred direct line to the IRS, they know which agents to deal with and who to avoid. It's not all bad news for you because Tax Network USA learned of a special limited time IRS offer. They're willing to waive $1 billion in penalties if you qualify. So schedule your free confidential consultation to see if you qualify for this limited time IRS penalty canceling offer. To do so, call 1-800-245-6000. That's 1-800-245-6000 or visit tnusa.com/justnews. That's tnusa.com/justnews. All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. And as promised, a very special and groundbreaking guest, Madison Cawthorn, the youngest member of Congress. He'll be sworn in January 3rd at the age of 25, a remarkable election he ran. And now he'll be representing the 11th District of North Carolina. Madison, welcome to the show.
John, thanks for having me on. It's an honor.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you, and I have to call you Congressman-elect now. That's a pretty darn cool title. I like that.
Well, thank you. I'll say it's a whole lot better than candidate.
So I'm for sure, for sure.
Looking forward to being able to get to work for my people come January 3rd.
Yeah, it's very important, representing those constituents. So a lot of our folks have heard the story of how you got elected, but what is when you look back at your extraordinary rise, winning the primary against a candidate that had been endorsed by a lot of the other power brokers in the Republican Party, and then coming through, beating the Democrat, taking all sorts of attacks against you from left, right, all across. What are some of your biggest takeaways from the election, running for your first office, scoring Congress? What did you take away from this?
You know, I think it all comes down to intentionality. I think that elections are simple to win if you have a good message, you can deliver that message, but also you know where you need to deliver it. My best friend and I, he's 22 years old. He happened to be my campaign manager.
Wow.
So I was 24 at the time, was not even constitutionally eligible to be a congressman during the primary.
Right.
Running against a Donald Trump-endorsed candidate, although we are huge for President Trump. We run against a Donald Trump endorsed candidate, running up against, basically every power broker in Washington was backing this other candidate, including the outgoing congressman. And so we had to sit down and come up with an unorthodox way to be able to beat this traditional campaign we were running against. And so we played it. I don't know if you've ever seen Moneyball, but it's significantly similar to how they did that.
How about that
program? Indeed. So we broke down what our number one vote goal was for the entire district. Then we broke that down to each county. Then we broke that all the way down to each precinct. So it was easy to gain volunteers because I said, hey, I need to get 16 votes out of your neighborhood. Can you do that? And almost everyone said, yeah, we can deliver 16 votes for you. And then that ended us up having probably one of the most effective and robust ground games probably in the country throughout this election.
Amazing.
And because of that, we were able to come pull off a victory.
So how does someone at the age of 25 with a campaign manager at the age of 22, if I add your two ages together, you're still not as old as I am. How did you learn all of those skills so quickly? Because you're right. Everybody thinks politics about the ads and the message. The message is important, but ground game and precinct and head counts and vote counts are really what wins election. How did you get trained so quickly? What got you so deeply ingrained in the ground game of politics?
Incredible mentorship. We definitely sought out a lot of wise counsel from people who ran campaigns before. Then we got that. And so we kind of had the background knowledge of that. But also due to, being raised in Generation Z, social media is really just second nature to me.
Yeah.
And so our entire campaign, it was very integrated within our campaign to have a strong social media presence. We knew if you could grab these big conservative ideas and put them into a small, well-wrapped package, it was easy to deliver to people. And people enjoy being able to be talked to in a way they can understand, not someone who's using Washington speak.
Yeah.
So we just came to people as real Americans. And I'll tell you, I just spent the last 10 days up in Washington, D.C., and it has become abundantly apparent to me that the people in Washington are not like normal Americans. They're political animals who will do anything for the lust for power.
Yeah, guilty. No doubt about it. I've experienced that in 30 years here, and you're absolutely right about it. So how was those 10 days? I mean, you go to orientation, you're meeting with members of Congress, you're probably passing by AOC in the halls. What was that 10 days in Washington like?
It was incredible. I definitely thought that it was amazing that there's really no playbook to how you can be a congressman. Now, if you want to just be, another rank and file member in the establishment, then there's definitely a playbook. You just do what leadership says and right. Everything will fall into line. But if you're trying to really go out and branch out on your own, I kind of liken it to, almost – you think of a Harry Potter or a Gandalf in one of these great works of fiction. They're handed a wand, and you as the viewer, you don't exactly know what they can do with that wand, but it holds incredible power. That's a lot what it's like coming into Congress, because there's really no limitations onto what you can and cannot do in Congress aside from what the Supreme Court will allow you to do. And so aside from that, if you want to shape a new path and chart a new path for your party or for your country, you're able to help really affect that change. And it was striking to me that, you're looking around and I'm seeing all these people. And the weight of responsibility really became very real to me when I realized, wow, I represent 700,000 people in Washington, D.C., and I'm their
Amazing.
Only voice. And so it means it's time to really step up and get to work.
Yeah, no, it is. And you're going to be judged now, not on how you ran your campaign, but how you conducted yourself in getting policy done and getting the constituent services done. It's a big task. The you tweeted something recently that has really captured my attention, because I've been preaching this for quite some time in when I give speeches or talk to people. The back end of the millennial generation and the Gen Z generation, they get pasted as, you know, liberal socialists. But in fact, if you look at the younger side of the millennials and almost the entire Gen Z, it looks like they're really freedom lovers. They're more like the founding fathers than any generation in America in quite some time. Do you think we old folks here in Washington and in the political establishment, do we have that generation wrong? Are they really freedom lovers and about to become libertarian conservatives?
No, you actually have that pegged exactly right. It's definitely, I would say a libertarian conservative is probably the best way to describe my generation, because, you know, we have very conservative politics. You know, a lot of people in my generation were alive to see what happened in 2008 when, you know, we saw what poor financial decisions can do to a household and can do to an entire country. And so we know that we want to have conservative politics to where we are wise and fiscally responsible. We also have seen, you know, I was alive to see our Twin Towers fall. I remember it vividly. And so I know that I want to have a very secure country. I want to know that I'm safe. I can, that there are brave men and women who will put on a uniform and go fight and die to keep us free and safe. And so because of that, you know, I think that gives us that, that lends itself to leaning towards the conservative spectrum of politics. But also in the generation that we've been raised in, we also realize that, you know, Republicans choosing to die on a lot of social hills has made us less effective in the minds of most millennials. And I think that's what's really pushed them over to the far left. And so because of that, you know, I think we should push almost every social decision down back down to the states.
Make it a states' rights issue, right?
Exactly, just as the founding fathers intended. And I think that's why you're probably making that comparison to where we are very similar to the founding fathers. You know, at the end of the day, as long as it doesn't break, you know, your certain inalienable rights, and also doesn't break, you know, what your decisions don't harm another person, then aside from that, it should go be pushed down to the states. And because of that, I think it appeals to a very wide range of people, and it turns us into the big tent party.
Now, you being a very strong libertarian and having those freedom instincts, what have you made of the last year with COVID-19 and the different ways that, you know, how a California versus a North Dakota versus a Virginia and a Florida have handled it? What takeaways do you have in the way the local and the federal government have played the COVID-19 crisis? Because obviously it is a crisis, but are you satisfied we have the right remedies?
No, I'm not. You know, it does not seem to me that lockdowns work. And now, in the very beginning, I completely understand having logistical issues. That's a very understandable problem that a hospital can have. You know, they have a budget. They're trying to stick to that budget, and they don't want to buy more paper cost goods than what they think they're going to need.
Right.
And so, you know, when they say that we need, you know, 14 days to flatten the curve or to help, to me, it wasn't necessarily about flattening the curve, but really it was about making sure that they had the appropriate amount of PPE equipment, that they had the right amount of ventilators, we had enough ICU beds. And I'm very happy to say that because we took literally those 14 days, and I think everyone in America took it seriously,
right?
Not a single person in our country that needed a ventilator went without a ventilator. And I think that's a testament to the current administration. It's a testament to really American ingenuity. You look at Elon Musk, who's able to provide so many. It's really quite incredible.
Yeah.
And so, but post that, I do not believe that the lockdowns have been effective as a real means to keep people safe. Now, if you're afraid of COVID and you want to stay inside, that's completely understandable. Now, if you have pre-existing conditions, you know, you have a heart condition, you have lung conditions, you have diabetes, you're over the age of 65, then of course, take the appropriate precaution that you need to do. But if you are somebody who has, you know, statistically a 99.9% survival rate with COVID-19, then I think you should be allowed to stay out inside of the workplace and stay out inside of the country so we can keep our economy going, keep our society moving forward. And so I think that just trying to solve these problems with perpetual lockdowns, one, it will destroy our economy. And because of financial problems, that's going to lead to more single-parent households because, you know, we all know that financial issues are the number one cause of divorces in the country. We also know that, you know, what is taught in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, is that, you know, if you're having a really intense urge to have a drink, then go somewhere that's public and sociable. It's not in a drinking setting. And so you can get away from that. So I think we've seen a significant increase in suicides due to alcoholism. And I think we've also seen a significant increase in the amount of child abuse and just abuse that happens, domestic abuse that happens in the homes. And so when they say that these lockdowns might help, sure, they might help the number of COVID-19 related problems, but they create a whole litany of other problems. And I think it makes the cure worse than the actual disease.
Yeah, it's a point that I think we're going to have a lot of takeaways when we go back and armchair quarterback the last year. Moving on to another issue that I know is really important to you and I think could be a real opportunity in the next Congress. Obviously, you're going into a house where the speaker is going to be Nancy Pelosi, but you've talked a lot about the big tech companies and the need to rein them in and to end the sort of suppression of free speech that we've seen. And I know that's going to be a very important part of your agenda as you go in. What have you seen and learned? And do you think there's a bipartisan deal to be had to break up the big tech oligopolies and other or take other action that will open up free speech in America again?
Yes, I do believe there's probably a way we can move forward. But the it being bipartisan, it depends what part of the Democratic Party you're working with. I do sincerely believe that the Democratic Party has been hijacked by the far left. And in my opinion, I don't think that their number one priority is, you know, climate change. I don't think their number one priority is health care. I believe that the number one policy priority of the far left radical Democrats is elections. They want to be able to control what is said and what you can and cannot do and how you can vote so that they can gain power and keep it forever. And so I believe that it is incumbent upon us in America to fight back against that. And a way we can do that is by continuing to protect our rights to free speech. So, you know, I have a video series when I normally post them on Facebook and Instagram that I call the Newtown Square. And the reason I'm doing that is because I want to really ingrain in people's minds that these Newtown Squares that we have, that although they are private companies, these social media companies are acting as a platform. That means that it's within the town square. And if you can't go into the town square and freely and openly debate ideas that might hurt somebody's feelings, then that means that we're going to be able to just go like sheep to the slaughter. And we won't be able to actually fight back against what's going to come from the radical Democrats. Because in my mind, all they want is power. And I pray to God that they never get it. But I'll tell you, I do believe there might be a way to get a bipartisanship inside of these big tech companies to where we can actually work forward with some of the Democrats to be able to try and pass, you know, sensible legislation that treats these companies more like a utility rather than a private company. The day that big government starts telling private companies what they can do, that's one major step back towards communism. And so we can't allow that to happen. But we do understand that because of basic necessities of life, you know, things like water and electricity, they have to be treated differently than, say, you know, a pizza company down the road.
So the argument would be that because Facebook and Twitter thrive on internet communication lines across state lines or across the public utility use right of ways, that there may be some exercise of government power to make sure that they allow those to be used freely. Is that sort of the thinking you have on big tech?
You're exactly right, John. That's exactly where my mind's going.
Wow. Interesting. That's going to be a fun argument to watch. And, you know, there's an interesting dynamic because Democrats just think they're too big and they want to break them up like they broke up Ma Bell and AT&T 20, 30 years ago. So there's this interesting dynamic where the free speech interests of the libertarians and the conservatives could align with certain Democrats to get some things going. When you look at the emerging platforms, the Rumbles and the Parlors of the world, the Clout Hubs, are you feeling more confident that competition can also solve this problem? If you get thrown off one platform, another one invites you on, the competition of ideas may exist. Are you heartened to see new platforms coming up?
I am heartened to see that. I really think specifically, I believe Parler has been doing an incredible job of marketing himself as the free speech destination.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that I am confident. I believe that competition solves almost every single problem we face in America, including healthcare.
Right.
I believe that when you let the free market reign, it works very well. But, you know, it's hard to have a free market system when you have these giant monopolies like we have with Facebook and Google. And so I'm looking forward to these, specifically Parler and a lot of these other platforms that you mentioned coming up to create the competition we need.
Yeah, that's, I think, going to be one of the really fun dynamics to watch in 2021, because these platforms are just getting to critical mass now where they're able to compete in that space. And I think that'll be one of the big things we'll be watching. As you look ahead to next year, what are some of your other policy priorities, other things you want to accomplish in your first year in Washington as a congressman?
Well, I definitely wanted to assess the battlefield that I was going into. And so, you know, a big thing that I want to do is really be the face of healthcare reform for the American people within the Republican Party. Wow. Simply because I represent the consumer end of a normal healthcare consumer. And I think I can bring a unique perspective because of that. But unfortunately, I don't believe that there's going to be any bipartisanship with the Democrats with my ideas, because where they want socialized medicine, I just basically want to take us back to the Wild West. Let's have free market capitalism reign within the healthcare systems, because really we've never had the free market touch healthcare. Really, the laws were written in 1942. They're antiquated and they're outdated. But the Democrats and the Republicans and myself, we have vastly different ideas of how we can get that solved. So assessing my battlefield, knowing that's a battle we won't be able to win, one that I do think we'll be able to get past is definitely something that's going to go along the lines of infrastructure reform. I'm sure it's no secret to you, John, but in a lot of places in rural America, like
it's
some of the
West, what's happening.
Indeed. And so in some of the rural counties in America, you know, it's very difficult for them to get broadband connection.
Yep.
And when you have these areas that have a willing and able and ready workforce, but you don't have the actual infrastructure needed for manufacturing jobs or for textile mills, that's going to make it more difficult upon us to be able to get jobs back from China. And so I definitely want to fix those infrastructure problems so that we can have a stronger economy. But I just want to use this one point as a segue to one of my most important things, and I think it will be the battle of my age against a foreign power. I really want to get upon the Foreign Affairs Committee so that we can really take on China head on. I think that the way that you can tell they're playing a very long-term game.
But
it's time for us to start fighting back boldly. Donald Trump is the first president I know of, you know, in the last 30 years who's really openly stood up to China. And I'm telling you, it's time to get tough on China.
Yeah, and there's no doubt. And you can see the gains they're making, particularly now beyond the Asia-Pacific Rim now, but in the Asia-Pacific Rim, particularly what's happened in Hong Kong, what they're threatening to do with Taiwan. It is the number one foreign policy challenge of the future. And it's great to hear a young person like you, you know, really focused on that and zeroing in, because it's going to be an important discussion. And many here in Washington are favorable to China because they have financial or other entanglements. And so it'll be an interesting opportunity for you to sound the alarm. Going back to healthcare, because I think it is one of those missed opportunities that Republicans have not been able to deliver an alternative that's resonated. Do you have a couple ideas that you could throw out there that would show a different approach to healthcare? Because I do think that that's an issue when people are faced with socialized medicine or single payer medicine versus a market alternative. They always want the market alternative. What do you see as some good ideas that could resonate and gain traction across the country?
I think simplifying the arguments, as we saw when we had the majority in 2016 to 18, what we really saw happen was that, you know, all we said is we want to repeal and replace Obamacare. But John, you're a very shrewd political commentator, so you might know this. But I don't think that the majority of Americans actually knew what Republicans wanted to replace it with.
Right.
And so because of that, it was hard to rally the people behind us. And because we live in a democratic republic, you have to have that public support. So I think that we need to simplify our message and make it very clear. And, you know, in my opinion, I think that we need to take this back to, you know, where I live right now. I'm in Western North Carolina. And from where I'm sitting, I can pick up a phone and there are four pizza companies that will deliver to my house right now. And so I think that it could be simplified to the fact that saying, hey, you know, those four companies are there competing for my dollars and for my business. And so because of that, they are going to try and get me the best tasting pizza, meaning the highest quality, right, at the fastest possible way they can get it here for the least amount of money. And if they can promise me those three things, then they're for sure going to get my money. But because of that, that's going to create a market-based system amongst those four companies to where they are going to start really striving to give the best service they possibly can. And I think that if we implemented that into our healthcare systems, where we remove a lot of this regulation that exists around a lot of the insurance companies, you know, where you have to get a certificate of need to operate inside of a state, I think that would increase the amount of competition, and it would help hold these insurance companies and healthcare providers accountable. Because right now, in North Carolina, where I live, Blue Cross Blue Shield ultimately has basically a virtual monopoly across this entire state. And so I think that we need to introduce some more legislation to reduce the regulations around healthcare. I think that would cheapen it and make it more affordable, more accessible for people.
This telemedicine, which we kind of all converted to quickly with COVID-19, if you had a sore throat, you didn't go to the doctor's office, you called them on your phone and you did that. Does that give some unique opportunities, not only to create competition, but to extend access without the normal expense of a doctor's visit, a lab visit, all those things? As someone who has, you know, strongly urged the use of technology to move this country forward, do you see that as one of the new emerging areas for cheap, effective healthcare for people who don't have it today?
Absolutely. The example for that is, I just want to say, look at the market share that Amazon has right now.
Yeah.
When you move away from this brick and mortar mentality, it creates significantly less cost overhead, and you can service more customers because of that. And so I think that's a great avenue for us to choose.
It's going to be an interesting time. So you'll get to Washington. You'll get sworn in on the 3rd. What does your first month look like? Do you have a 30-day agenda of what you want to try to accomplish in those in that first month?
Well, you know, I know a lot of people are trying to position for spots on leadership in the future, or they're trying to get their footholds to go to the next rung of political power. But I'll tell you, I think that that's the problem with Washington, D.C. We don't have enough representatives. And so my first 30 days are completely district focused. I want to have the most robust, most efficient, and easiest and most accessible constituent services that out of any congressman across this country. So, you know, I'm really going to be focused here at home in the district. You know, I specifically want to make sure that my main place of residence, where my family is, where I live, is still here in Western North Carolina, so that I look these people in the eyes every single day and I know that I'm not going to betray them. I know what their needs are. I think we have far too many people who live inside of a bubble of Washington, D.C. And so because of that, they're unable to really effectively know what the people in their constituency want. And so my first 30 days is going to be all about the district.
Wow, that's an important message to send. How about that? One last question, because it's one that I know when I talk to the young people here in the office and around the country, the crushing deficit, the debt, the excessive spending, the explosion of the size of government. We have government agencies upon government agencies that supervise government agencies. It's crazy. Do you have any ambitions to start efforts to shrink the size of bureaucracy and government, try to get it back down to a manageable cost and also a manageable a bureaucracy that actually is responsive to the American people?
I absolutely do. You know, this is something I campaign pretty heavily on.
Yeah.
And John, I'll tell you, if you ever have to prove this to somebody, just tell them that to say that our government has grown too large, just say, hey, pick any three letters within our alphabet, put them together, and the odds really are in your favor that you will have have the acronym for some major government agency or division that is designed to tell us what we can and cannot do. I really think these three-letter agencies, as I like to call them, have become the fourth branch of government. But unfortunately, we don't have there's no real checks and balances like there are on the other three branches of government. And so I want to introduce some legislation where we can have direct oversight of these particular agencies inside of our country, and to give us a line item veto of budget, so we can go through and say, you know, why are we giving the ATF, you know, however many billions of dollars we give them every single year? Let's limit that so that we can rein them in and protect the American people. I think that's one of the number one policy positions the Republicans should have, because again, if you want to win my generation, just promise us more freedom, and we'll come along.
Such an important point. Well, Congressman-elect, we're excited for your adventure that is about to start on January 3rd. We're going to be following you here closely at justthenews.com. Our congressional correspondent, Nick Ballasy, I'm sure will be in touch. But we wish you luck, and we look forward to having you back on the show after the new year.
Great, John. Well, I looked forward to shaking up our country, so hopefully it'll be pretty newsworthy. I can't wait to come back on.
Sounds like a good plan. All right, folks, we're going to go to a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up for the day. Folks, Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. Why? It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. I love the fruit flavors particularly, and it's completely improved my life and my health. This is nutrition the way nature intended. When I began taking a hard look at why I wasn't feeling good and why I felt unhealthy, why I was gaining weight, why I was losing energy, it wasn't just because I had hit my 50s. No, it was because I wasn't getting the right amount of fruit and vegetables in my diet. And listen, I'm just too busy to go to the store, clean up the vegetables, cook vegetable dinners, and make sure I hit the fruit. A Field of Greens stepped in. One scoop of powder in my drink or on my eggs in the morning, and boom, I was off and feeling better. And suddenly, I was losing weight. I was sleeping better. My metabolism went up. My blood sugar went down. My cholesterol went down, and my weight went down. And my doctor said, hey, whatever you're doing, keep it doing. You know what that is? It's Field of Greens. That's what I've been doing. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you, you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guaranteed. Now, you're going to get 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping because of the incredible partnership we have here at Just the News with Brick House Nutrition, and of course, Field of Greens. All you got to do to take advantage of this offer, visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JustNews. That's promo code JustNews at fieldofgreens.com. Don't wait. Go to fieldofgreens.com today. Use the promo code JustNews for 15% off. All right, folks, that wraps up another edition of John Solomon Reports. We hope you liked the podcast and all we did with it today. It was a good interview with Madison Cawthorn. I learned a lot. You can see a young congressman already starting to burble ideas and come up with a policy agenda that appeals to young people, to centrists, to libertarians, expanding the Republican tent that Donald Trump has massively expanded already. Very interesting conversation, somebody to keep an eye on. I hope you also enjoyed the analysis of the 12 most important pieces of evidence that are concrete or, you know, solid that have emerged in the election integrity investigation. We think those are worth looking at and diving in. We will be back tomorrow with another great show. Until then, have a great night. Be safe, and may the Lord bless you and this great country.
It's Amanda Head, and I am thrilled to introduce to you my new exciting podcast, Furthermore with Amanda Head, broadcasting weekly from sunny Los Angeles, California, and brought to you by the dynamic Just the News Podcast Network. On this fresh and engaging podcast, I delve into the latest news with a little bit of a twist, exploring the furthermore of every story. But this isn't your typical run-of-the-mill news commentary or politically charged program. I interview a diverse range of guests, including business leaders, entertainers, musicians, educators, experts, politicians, and many influential figures from both the United States and around the world. So why not make your Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays a little more interesting? Tune in on your preferred podcast platform and discover Furthermore with Amanda Head on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button and be sure to download the latest episodes. I can't wait to have you join me on this exciting journey.
At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.